The date is April 1st, 2024. Just picking up on some things from last class. You remembered something, Rabbi Kelman, which I didn't remember. I asked, so what is this business of being outside? And I think you remembered it for a wedding. I forgot what you said. I think you said about being under the stars, all that.
That's the minhag, to be under the stars. I remember in the shul in Budapest, they had that little place where they used to go to make
Well,
the
that's
weddings.
different. That's outside because they don't want, they have that's something separate because they don't
Right, they
believe in
don't want it in the
davening in the
shul.
synagogue. But I asked, so why daven outside? Well, what's the big deal about being? I thought you gave an answer as to why.
I said the first half of the month, I think. I mean, I said if you
Yeah.
that the people, we don't have this anymore, I don't think.
Yeah.
People used to dafka make the wedding the first 15 days of the new moon while the moon is getting stronger.
Okay, well, listen, that's not what I know. We have a lot of Talmidei Chachamim listening to us, and often I say something like, I don't know, and I get a lot of comments, and people point it out. No one pointed out this to me. I happen to find it myself. It's explicit Shulchan Aruch, Evin Ezer, Siman Samach Aleph, Halacha Aleph in the Ramah. The Ramah says, Yesh Omrim. There are those who say, La'asos ha'chuppah tachas ha'shamayim. You should do the chuppah under Shemaim. So it's a, I don't, I guess most of us are not learning Evin Ezer. And he gives the reason why. Just like Avraham Avinu, the blessing, his children will be like the stars of heaven. So too, we do it outside. You know, it's getting dark, so we see the stars. And I don't know if that's the original reason why it started, but that's once they had the minhag, some people had the minhag. Geshomim, not everyone. And that's the reason they give, so that they'll have children like the stars of the heaven. Now, it's funny because I'll say in a few minutes from now, Rabbi Shua ben Levi, lots of people have something to say about Rabbi Shua ben Levi, Amora Tana. But a Beferish Raman, the Shulchan Aruch, no one commented on. I have to correct myself because I realized this afterwards. I said that the only thing that's well known about Rav Leibola Shapiro, the father of Raphael Shapiro, of who's Rav of Kovno's father, is, we're going to deal with Raphael Shapiro later. Raphael Shapiro, it's great because he's from the Volozhin Yeshiva, anti-Musar, but in the end, he too has to accept Musar, as we'll see. That's going to be the end result, the story, that Musar wins an absolute victory or almost absolute victory. But there's one other thing I need to tell you, a famous story about Rav Leibola Shapiro, called him Leibola Kovner. And I think it's also a worthwhile story for a different reason, that it you know, how we view rabbis. And the story is as follows, that in this story was told by Rav Zalman Meltzer. He Rav Leibola told by Rav Zalman Meltzer in a conversation with the Chazon Ish. Rav Leibola Shapiro was Matir and Aguna. That's what rabbis do. They're Matir and Aguna sometimes, which they're based in. And she remarried. And lo and behold, after she remarried, the husband shows up. So, wow, now you got a real problem. First of all, she can't remain married to the second husband, and she can't be with the first husband. If she had children, they're mamish mamzerim. And the Chazon Ish was nonplussed by the story we're told. He said that, hold on a second, I'll find, after hearing the story, because you're going to say, how could such a thing happen? The Chazon Ish, it didn't concern him at all. He said that it's a Beferish Mishnah. Here we are in Yevamos, Pei Zion HaBeis. It says, Ha'isha Shahalach Ba'al HaMedina, a woman whose husband went overseas, and they came and they told you your husband died and she married. Based on that, and afterwards her husband came. So the Mishnah already recognizes that this is a possibility, that you could have a situation like this. So does this mean that the Rav Leibola Shapiro was wrong? He made a mistake? I mean, it could be that there, but we assume not. He did what Halacha says. There were two Edim. If you have two Edim who come and testify that they saw this person before they buried him, and he had all the simanim, whatever they need, and based on that, you free the woman. So the Edim are wrong. But sometimes bad things like this happen. I mention this only because in the arts, well, not, no, I mentioned it because of Rav Leibola Shapiro, but now this last point that you know, this could happen. And the Chazon Ish, as I said, he reports that, okay, these things happen. You just have to, the Chazon Ish's words are, that he has to just, he has to do what he can. Because in the Art Scroll biography of Moshe Feinstein, it has a story there, which I don't believe, precisely because of what we just saw. And the Mishnah, where after the war there was an aguna and the rabbis martyred her, and lo and behold, the husband shows up, and her Moshe says, "It's impossible. I can't believe it that I knew this rabbi. He never would have martyred." And he ends up speaking to the woman, and the woman acknowledges she lied about something. And the result of this is you're supposed to, the result of the story, the upshot is that any rabbi who properly follows the halacha, he'll never have such a situation. It's only if they fool the rabbi or lie to him or something like that. And we see that that's not the case. That there, you know, if the edim are valid edim, it's the edim's fault, but it's not the rabbi. The rabbi is doing what he's supposed to do. And so that's the story with Rav Lebo Shapiro. There was a case like this, a famous case in Eretz Yisrael after the Holocaust. It's not like today, you know, with communications. This woman, her husband was dead. So she thought, she remarried with a heter. She had children, two sons, as I recall. They were in Ponevej Yeshiva. And lo and behold, the other husband shows up in Israel. Maybe he was in Argentina. Who knows where he was? It took years sometimes to find this spouses. So now you have a real case of Mamzerus. It went all the way to Ritzi Pesach Frank. And Ritzi Pesach Frank, at the time, it was kept under wraps. But now, recently, it's been written about. We have documentation. He did the famous get of the Maharsham to when we after this we're going to do Rav Shlomo Molivor, but then we'll get into Rav Langer and we'll speak about this, a way to solve the Mamzerus problem recommended by the great Maharsham Rav Shlomo Shvadron, that you send someone to give a get and then you abolish the get, and then the rabbis say that the marriage was never chal from the beginning. We'll get into it. It's a theoretical, or at least it was theoretical, that now it became practical. And that's how they're metahir the children. Okay, two more things. After the class, right at the end, we were talking about reality. You know, if you have the facts, doesn't matter if the Gadol HaDor says it, if he's wrong, if he doesn't have the facts, you have to point it out to him. We spoke about how Rabbi Konvitz said with Rav Meir Feimer. You know, Rav Meir Feimer is saying all these crazy things about the Slabodka Yeshiva, which is completely inaccurate. Don't assume, incidentally, that all the people criticizing Musa were like Rav Meir Feimer, just repeating these nonsensical things they heard. It's not true. There are substantive issues we're going to have to deal with. And just to, before we even get into the issues, probably the two leading opponents of the Musar movement publicly were Rav Avraham Borstein of Tavrig and Rav Itzla of Ponevej, Rav Itzla Rabinovich. Rav Itzla Rabinovich was viewed as the greatest Machadish, even greater than Reb Chaim in his day before World War I. Now we think of Reb Chaim. I don't know how many people even remember Rav Itzla. Rav Itzla learned B'chavrusa Reb Chaim for 2 years in Brisk. But Rav Yitzhak Rabinovich, the Zecher Yitzhak, was regarded as the greatest genius and the one creating Chidushim in the yeshiva world. They both taught. Rav Itzla and Rav Borstein both taught at the Sabbatka Yeshiva. So they left. Apparently they were fired. Rav Itzla was fired. I don't know about Rav Borstein. And they were the leading Musar opponents. So they knew from the inside what Musar was all about. Rav Borstein, by the way, was Rosh Yeshiva at, or I don't know if his title was Rosh Yeshiva, Rebbe, at Sabbatka Yeshiva at 18 years old. And students were older than him. At Slabodka Yeshiva, he had people from age 13 into the late 20s. And so we spoke about this idea, you know, Avraham Konvitz gets up and Yosef Konvitz gets up and says he can criticize what Rav Feimer says because he doesn't have the facts. And we spoke about that. And Rabbi Kelman mentioned, Rav Schachter pointed this out. So I thought of something. Actually, I had that experience too. I had a conversation with the late Rabbi David Sheinkopf. We've spoken about David Sheinkopf. We dealt with he wrote this book on Kitnios, and in fact, I'm going to tell for the podcast, I'm going to tell the person in charge of the podcast to put the Kitniot podcast up before Pesach, maybe in 2 weeks. But he wrote a book on Kitnios, derivatives, and on gelatin, and he passed away, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. I spoke to him once, You know, he disagrees with Rav Avadia. He permits gelatin, but not from pig skin, just bones from beef. He says, Rav Avadia Yosef, he says he's never been in a plant. He's never actually seen gelatin made. So therefore, what he's saying to me basically is that I don't have to hold of his opinion or even care about his opinion because he doesn't have the facts. So this is what I thought of in terms of facts. I was thinking about, I don't know, because the Pesach program, whatever, because a number of years ago, I was at a hotel for Pesach, and I was speaking to the Mashgiach, and we're talking Kashrus. I have a great interest in Kashrus issues, and talking about Bishalakum and fish and things, and he told me that he asked Rav Tendler the following. There's a klal in Bishalakum. If you can eat it fresh, and you can cook it, there's no issue of Bishalakum. So an anju goes there for you. That is, if you take something that you can eat raw, then by definition, there's no issue of bishalakum. So the Mashgiach told me, I don't know what his connection to Rabbi Tendler was, because he seemed quite yeshivish, but whatever, maybe it came from Muncie. He asked Rabbi Tendler, what about today tuna? Because we know that sushi, people eat raw tuna. I mean, you have to ask a shaila on this. I don't think this means that all fish then would not be an issue of bishalakum. I think we still have to, I'm assuming you have to divide some fish yes, some fish no. But let's stick with tuna. So tuna is sushi. People eat it raw, so therefore there shouldn't be an issue of bishalakum. And what Rabbi Tendler's reply to him was, it's not common enough yet. One day maybe, but today it's a miyut. It's a miyut. It's a very small minority of people are eating sushi. So I remember thinking, and this was like probably seven, eight years ago, what's he talking about? Has Rabbi Tendler not been to a wedding? Everyone's eating sushi. It's like the most popular thing. I was in San Antonio last week. Incidentally, we spoke about the word san in previous classes, how Chabad often won't say san. So for if you go to the website, there's no Chabad of San Francisco. It's S. Francisco. But I also told you that some Chabads don't seem to have a problem. In San Antonio, the Chabad has no problem S-A-N, San Antonio. But okay, so I'm in San Antonio, and they have a nice supermarket there with a kosher aisle, and they have sushi. In San Antonio, the one thing they need to have is kosher sushi. So everywhere you go, there's kosher sushi. So can I, on my own, just decide that, you know what? I'm looking around. Everyone, there seems to be a lot of people eating raw tuna. That means it's not bishalakum anymore. Or do I need to, is that something where I can just decide on my own? Or do I need to ask a shaila? Because it's clear that Rabbi Tendler is wrong, at least in my opinion. It's definitely not a mute. There's a good percentage of people. Do you need 30%, 40%, 50%? I don't know. But there's a lot of people who have no problem eating and enjoy eating it. So that's a good question. I don't know. The last thing I want to do before we get two more things. A number of you emailed me, very learned. We spoke about Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Is he an Amora or a Tana? And a number of you emailed me the same thing. The Chiddush speaks about it, the Rambam. Okay, a lot of discussion about this. And a lot of people say it's a machlokas between Rashi and the Rambam. I don't know if it's a machlokas. The Chiddush tries to say, well, he has aspects of a Tana. You know, he's quoted in a couple places in the Mishnah. But he has also aspects as a Mora, somewhere in the middle. But the reason they say that he's a Tana is because the Rambam, they say the Rambam quotes him in the introduction of the Mishnah as a Tana. And that's why a lot of people say he's a Tana, and so it's a Machokas. By the way, the Chiddush quotes an opinion that there's two Rabbi Yeshua ben Levis, one who's a Tana and one who's an Amora. And he says that that's obviously not true. But I thought of that because maybe next class I'll tell you there was a huge issue with Rav Yitzchak Yosef. I'm not going to tell you today. I'll tell you next class. Rav Yitzchak Yosef and this business of two. Can there be two Avrahams, two Yaakovs, two Eretz Israels? It's a bit of a scandal involving Rav Yitzchak Yosef. But I'll share this with you next class because it's not about tearing Yitzchak Yosef down. It happens to be one of the major rabbinic scandals in recent memory and was all over the press. So I do feel that I should share it with you. But so why do I say that I'm not convinced that the Rambam holds this opinion? Because the Rambam, if you look at the Parashat Mishnah, never says And I'm, as far as I can tell, no one points this out. So maybe I'm wrong. If Chidor doesn't mention this, all the people cite this. But the Rambam, don't say what I'm going to say now, but it's clear to me. The Rambam never says that Rabbi Shua ben Levi is an introduction to the Mishnah. He never says that he's a Tana. What he says is he's going to give a list of the Chachamim who are Shenizkaru b'Mishnah, who are mentioned in the Mishnah, b'gal masa she'ira b'zman echad mehem, because of an event that happened, or musar sheli made, or they taught something, or, you know, things that are not halacha, drash, darash. All the Rambam does is he gives a list of all these rabbonim who are mentioned in the Mishnah. But he doesn't say that tonight. In fact, I'm looking at the Kafach translation. On Rabbi Shimon Levi, our Kafach says, niskar b'Mishnah, the Rabbim Choshim Shuon Amar Yitzchak Shirley Talmud Bakapara. Many people think that this is the one that's mentioned, the Amora. Sort of, I guess maybe Rav Kafach is assuming there might be two because he says many. He doesn't say this is the one mentioned. He says many think this is the one. Well, if it's not the one, then I guess there's two. But the point is that Rabbi Kafach is saying he's identifying him with an Amora who's mentioned in the Mishnah. And Rashi's explicit, and everyone basically who discusses is explicit that he has the status of an Amora. Okay, the last thing I want to share with you. Oh no, I'm sure we're done. Let's move on. Hold on. Let me get my papers out. Okay. If you recall, the last thing we spoke about is I mentioned, I introduced you to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Broida. There's a few people with this name Broida. I guess maybe the name Broid, same name. The Simcha Zissel of Kelm, his name was also Broida. That's so it was a popular name in Europe. And we saw already, and he's going to come to the defense of Rameir Feimer. We saw the attack of Rameir Feimer on the Musar students. One of the things he said, which was a bit strange, is he's not just attacking the idea of Musar. And that, you know, the cut, the idea that they have to create their own special elitist group. It's not just like they want to study the Messiah Shasharim. They want to create a special group. And then it's going to get even more strange for them because they have all sorts of ways of doing things that are different than elsewhere. But he also threw in that their method of learning is not appropriate. You know, they don't spend time on the Rishonim, which we said is not true. And he said that they all they do is they focus on the Ketzos. And I mentioned, although this isn't true, what Meir Feimer said, it is true that Ketzos was an important sefer that they studied for whatever reason. In fact, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, famous story Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg tells how he would study, I think he says Motzei Shabbos, if I'm not mistaken. I have it here. Yeah, every Motzei Shabbos that Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam would study Ketzos HaChoshen, and he would learn it with a chavrusa, and the Altar of Sabaka chose Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg to be his study partner. And he would learn with him Ketzos every Motzei Shabbos. And he talks about how what an experience this was. He also tells another story, though. It's famous. That he said that he asked Rav Naftali Amsterdam, who's Rav Naftali Amsterdam? Rav Shlomo Salanter had three great Talmidim, Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm. He opened a yeshiva, which had secular studies. Rav Yitzhak Blaser, Rav in St. Petersburg, Rav in, first of all, he was in Kovno, but also in St. Petersburg later, and he ends up in Yerushalayim and Naftali Amsterdam. These are the three great Talmidim. The altar was a student of Rav Simcha Zissel. Rav Naftali Amsterdam was the Rav in Helsingfors. That's how they used to call Helsinki. But anyone tells you you can't, Rav Moshe Sternbach has a tshuva. He says no one should live in Helsinki because there's a problem. You know, they don't know when it doesn't get dark. Well, he could say that, but we had Gedolei Yisrael who lived in Helsinki, and there always were communities who lived in Helsinki. And there was a YCT graduate who's the chief rabbi or was the chief rabbi at Helsinki, the community of Finland. He flew him in to study at YCT, and he went back there. In fact, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg's wife, who he divorced, after she divorced her, she became the wife of the chief rabbi of Helsinki. They were always using Helsinki because after the Cantonists got out, they would then move. They moved there, and they set up a community there in Helsinki. But what I want to share with you is he records that is Rabbi Weinberg, that he asked Rabbi Tully Amsterdam to give him a segula, a method, so he wouldn't forget. And so Rabbi Tully Amsterdam, and Rabbi Weinberg writes this. It's hard to imagine the God of Israel today telling this story. So Rabbi Tully Amsterdam asks him, what do you forget? And he says, sometimes I forget the daven mincha. Look, it's not so terrible. That's why we have the halacha. If you forget mincha, they tell you what to do. So maybe they'll tell you, well, that's only for people like us, we'll forget, but not for great Torah scholars. So no, Rabbi Weinberg says he would forget mincha. And Rabbi Natalia Amsterdam gave him, you want to be firm about it? He was busy learning. It's not being firm. That's what he was doing. He was busy learning and he forgot. After all, aren't we going to say in a few weeks, Pesach? The great rabbis would have forgotten maybe to do davening in the morning, Shema. They're so busy learning, the Talmidim have to come in B'nai Brak and tell them it's time. Ratzi Yehuda also used to forget Mincha. So Rav Tali Amsterdam, he looks at him and says, you forget Mincha? you see. So what does he do? So he says to him, no, he lies to him. He says to him, no, sometimes I forget the Davin B'Tzibur. Maybe I forget that there's a minyan, so by the time I remember the daven, the minyan's already over. And okay, so Rav Tali Amsterdam was satisfied. So he says that he came to the altar. We're going to talk more about the altar today, hopefully who he was. But he comes to the altar and he confesses before him what he did. After all, that's what you're supposed to do in the Musar Yeshiva. If you do something like this, you lie to the gadol, you're supposed to go to the other gadol and confess your sins. So he goes to him and he says that the altar of Sabatka yelled at him, Shakran! You deceived a great man and a tzaddik. He says, go to the Rav Naftali now and confess your lie. And Rabbi Weinberg says, I refuse to go. I'm not going. I'm not going to embarrass myself. But the altar forced him to go. And he says, if you don't go to confess your sin, you cannot step foot in my house again. This story, by the way, Rabbi Weinberg wrote it in a letter, and it's recorded in Dov Katz's book, Tnuas HaMusar. So he says he had no choice. So he started walking to Rav Natali's house to say that I lied to you. I missed davening. I forget it. And he said, I went there kechli, kechli malei busha, full of embarrassment. And as he's going there, however, it's a very long distance in the snow. Before he gets there, a student is sent from the altar. The altar sent a student to him and said, the altar wants you to come back. I guess it's sort of like the angel coming and telling Avraham not to sacrifice Yitzhak. The altar wants you to return. So he says, well, as Rabbi Weinberg said to him, well, I'm almost there at the house. I'm going to go Rav Tali. So he said, no. The altar does not want you to go to Rav Tali. So he says that I returned, I went to Rav Tali, and the altar, this was just one of his methods of self-improvement, one of his Musar exercises. He says, I didn't want you to be humiliated in front of Rav Tali Amsterdam, but I wanted you to uproot from yourself the zuama, the stain, or whatever you want to, the bad element of sheker. And since I saw that you were willing to go all the way, you were willing to go in and confess your sin, confess that you lied, that's enough. Then you no longer have this feeling of sheker. So this was, and Rabbi Weinberg says, this was the method of education, Derech HaChinuch of Sabbatka, that, they would, not to humiliate him, but to bring him to the point. Now, you might think this is a crazy method of education. We'll learn more about the altar's method of education, but that's that way he was willing to he was able to uproot Sheker. He was ready to acknowledge to Rav Naftali that he lied to him, but he doesn't actually have to go that final step. It's enough that he's willing to do it, and that's what the altar wanted. About Mincha, it's Rabbi Gov Katz, in a separate part in his Tuas HaMusar Volume 1, tells another story about Mincha. I'd be curious what the rabbis today would do about this. He says that Rav Yisroel was with a number of other rabbis, and they were having an important meeting dealing with one of the issues of the day, as these rabbis do. And it came time for Mincha. So Rav Yisrael said, time for Mincha, we have to break. He got up and started davening. And Rav Eliyahu Shik, he was the the Rav of Lida. He stopped him. This is on page 207, volume 1. And he said that we're dealing with a matter of pikuach nefesh of Kol Yisrael. We don't stop that the daven mincha. Osek b'mitzvah patur min ha-mitzvah. If we miss mincha, we miss it. We're dealing with it. And Rishon says to him, you know, from the standpoint of halacha, you're right. But if we follow this, then who knows where it'll lead. We'll forget mincha altogether, because I guess there's always going to be important things you're at. And Rav Eliel Schick stood his thing and said that your tefillah is a toeva if you're going to get up and daven right now. And he got up, though, to daven b'yechidus. And he said afterwards that Elov Elo Divrei Elohim Chayim, Rabbi Eliyahu, he had to show that Pikuach Nefesh is more important than Mincha. And I had to show that we can't accept this practice of not davening Mincha so that we don't abolish it entirely. Well, you know, there's another story, the Chazon Ish. This is recorded, if you're interested, in Ma'aseh Ish, Volume 5, page 136. This is something which is relevant, I think, even to us, maybe. He was asked the following question by Rav Beryl Kreuzer. He didn't realize that the shul had already davened. He come into a shul, and he's listening. There's a drasha. He didn't realize they had already davened. Now they're listening to the drasha. He thought the drasha is going on, and the drasha is going to finish, then they're going to be mincha time. So lo and behold, he's watching the sky, or his watch, and it's getting close to Shkia. Close to Shkia. What is he supposed to do? Because it's clear that maybe even ask someone, they said, we already davened. But he can't get up because and walk out, because that's disrespectful. So what does it say he does? He slowly moved to the back. Slowly, slowly, until right, like a minute before Shkia, he was right at the entrance, and you know, then he's either, it doesn't say if he slipped out or right in the back when no one would see him, then he could daven. You know, if you're in the back, he could slip out. So, but he wasn't sure whether this was correct, what he did. So he went to the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish said as follows, I'm going to read it to you. Eineni mevinas ha-sheila. I don't understand the question. Harei latseis pe'emsa drasha zo ha-banas panim v'darshan u'vizayon otam el chacham. To leave in the middle of a drasha? His question was, should I have left in the drasha to daven mincha? He says that you're embarrassing the darshan. Ubevadai shetfilas mincha eno dochazeh. The eno matir zeh. Ubevadai shasor, let's say. So here we see the Chazon Ish saying, if you're caught in this situation where you get in there and the rabbi's speaking and lo and behold, you're in minchas, you're going to miss mincha. You didn't realize it. You cannot get up and walk out and daven mincha because that's embarrassing. That people will think that you're showing disrespect to the rabbi. So, fascinating in my opinion. Okay, let's pick up where we are. I want to read you some now of, where is it? Of Rav Chaim Tzvi Hirsch Broida. After Meir Feimer publishes in Hamelitz his blistering attack on Musser, the Rav of Zager, his name was Rav Chaim Tzvi Hirsch Broida, comes to the defense of Meir Feimer. And what does he say? Well, he says as follows. And he's the first one to come out to strengthen Rav Meir Feimer. Soon we're going to see a huge document called Laman Da, signed by all the Gedolim. There's no question that the majority of the Gedolim, were of the big ones, were in opposition to the Musar movement. And yet, in the end, by the time of after World War I, everyone recognizes that even Rav Borstein of Tavrik, at the end of his life, he said that they were right, the Musar people. It's like with Rav Soloveitchik. He acknowledges that most of the Gedolim were against Zionism. He says so. But he says that, you know, God himself poskened that this was correct. So sometimes the majority of the... I know this is for the Haredi people listening. This is maybe... Well, not the ones listening to our classes, but in the Haredi world for many, and this is hard to accept, that the majority of Rabbanim could be wrong. But we've seen it again and again. The majority of Gedolim were against the Hasidim also. So we've seen this again and again. In fact, Rav Avi Ravitsky said that he doesn't understand all this business of following the Gedolim. He says on so many of the big issues of the day, the Gedolim were wrong. They were wrong on, he goes through the whole list. The difference is that other than the Hasidim, and even that maybe they wouldn't agree with, they're not going to agree that they're wrong on Zionism. They're not going to agree that they're wrong on Haskalah. They're not going to agree that they're wrong on any of these issues. But so what does Rav Broida say? He said, a very long article, also published in Hamelitz, and he says that the Sabatka people, and again, he tells us that he's acting on information that he heard. He never went to Slobodka. He never went to Slutsk to visit the students there. But he said that he's told, and he even says, everything I'm saying is im emes nachon adavar, if what I'm told is correct. But then he blasts that. Well, maybe, again, with all due respect to this great rabbi, maybe he should have confirmed if emes nachon adavar before he blasts them in such a terrible way. He says that they do minhagim muzarim, strange practices. They spend their day in examining their actions, and in viduim pumbim, public confessions. Now, we're going to see there is a place for these confessions, more in the Vardic, however, but not only. But when you read it, when you public, it's not like people are getting up in front of 200 people. It's a different situation. We'll talk about it. They lash themselves. I don't believe that's anyone in Slobodka ever lashed themselves. I don't even know if in Nevardik they did. There were people, tzaddikim, over the generations, who before Rosh Hashanah would want to do like a sort of malchus, just symbolic. I can show you a video from last Rosh Hashanah. Our colleague in Gerba sent it to the Jews of Gerba line up and they get malchus. Next time I'll show you maybe. They line up and they give each other a little malchus. He says they fall on the street. They announce Yalla Ve'Yovo when it's not Rosh Chodesh in order to embarrass themselves. This is very Navardic like. This isn't, no one in Slobodka was doing this. And he says that this is what I've been told. He also says, and this is more, I guess, rings more true, that they say that only from us, only from the Musar group, will Torah go forth because we have Torah v'yira b'yachad. That is true. The Musar students did think that their approach was the best approach, but why can't they think that? The other people think their approach is the best approach. Now, this sometimes could lead, as we mentioned last class, to negative feelings of others, but that's always the case. You always feel that your group is the better, and doesn't every Hasidic group feel that their Rebbe is the best, and every yeshiva feel, everyone, that's not enough of a reason for these sort of attacks. He says that the Musar students, they have negative feelings about the Gedolim, and they try to lessen them, so they don't really consider them Gedolim. It could be some did that, but that wasn't the case in Slobodka. And look, you might have had some extremists. Now, understand, if you feel that you need to have Musar in order to be a real Gadol Yisrael, and this rabbi doesn't believe in Musar, you could have feelings that he's really not such a great figure. But we know Chilak of Weinberg got smicha from the Rav of Kovno, from Rav of Slobodka, Moshe Donashevsky. He's an anti-Musar person. We know that they did not have these feelings. Soon we're going to talk about the Yerushalmi, Rav Yosef Sosmanovitz, anti-Musar, and yet they would go to him. He was also the Rav of Slobodka. So these are, what can I say? These are canards. He says, Shitas ha-Musar mazekes l'chlimon ha-Torah l'kiyuma. The whole Musar movement, this idea, and they're going to explain it in more detail later. There's no problem in, you want to read a Musar book, you feel like it's fine, but to set up a whole movement, which is now going to have its own groups and its own rituals and its own ways of doing things. And then we're going to see its own new figure called the Mashkiach. All of a sudden, instead of a Rosh Yeshiva, you have someone equal to the Rosh Yeshiva called the Mashkiach. He's not necessarily a Lamdin Mufak and Shasa Poskim. Usually he's not. So he's going to then be telling the students what to do. That's the job of the Rosh Yeshiva. So they see it as subverting the whole traditional form of the Yeshiva. He says that among these students, osim haTorah arai uvamusar keva. That is the most important thing for them. And the one they spent is Musar. Look, they spent most of the day. They spent a half hour, an hour maybe. Officially, it was a half hour Musar between Mincha Ma'ariv and Slobodka. So some would spend more, an hour. And then, of course, you have the Musar Shmuzin. But the Rov Minyan Ubinyan of the day, the majority of the day, 90% of the day, is focused on traditional Talmud learning. So he could say, well, when he says that the Musars, the Keva, it's because that's the most important thing. What can I say? It's not true. Even in Navardic, the Stipor comes out in Navardic. He's a Gadol Yisrael. He knows how to learn. So it's just not right. He says that the Torah is like secondary, like a fifth wheel. That's the word he uses. Limud HaTorah Tzlam Ka'ofen HaChamishi LeLimud HaMusar. That is the most important thing is Limud HaMusar. he goes too far. It is true that there were those in the Musar Yeshiva, and this itself is enough to create a problem. You had people whose attitude were Musar students that, you know, I'm not good at Gemara. That's not my thing. Like, he's in Yeshiva. Like, you're good at Gemara, you know Shasaposkin, but I'm in Musar. So you had like two types of Iluyim in the Yeshiva. You had the Talmudic Iluyim and I had the Musar Iluyim. Well, people like Reb Broida and others, the whole idea that you're, that you, you know, you, if you're not good at Gemara, what, just because you're good at Musar, what does that mean? You go in Merkas Harav. They have, for example, Emunah is a big thing there. So there are people there whose job it was Emunah. So they're not big Lamdanim, but they're big in Emunah. I guess there's a parallel being a Hasidic yeshiva, maybe someone in Hasidus. But from a Lithuanian yeshiva, that's a problem. And that's enough of a problem. You don't need to do what he says, that they didn't take the Torah seriously. Because that's going too far, and then he ends by saying continues by saying there's Musar Emes for Chachma. He says there's true Musar, and then there's Musar without Chachma. That is, there's true Anava, true modesty, humbleness, and then there's he said there's a sort of modesty which is really Gaiva. That is, there's a sort of modesty where you feel gaiva. You are modest, but you're really modest because of gaiva. It's like the old Navardic joke, which I've told before, and we're going to do about Navardic, because Navardic, a lot of these canards actually have some applicability to Navardic. But Navardic believed, unlike in general, Sobotka believed in Gadus Adam. It's a completely different philosophy. It's building you up. But Navarre believed in Shiflus Adam, tearing you down. So people would sit there, you know, you're a nobody trying to pull out that ego. So the old joke is these two old Navarrekers come into the base marriage and they see a guy there saying, you're a nobody to himself. And one says to the other, look who thinks he's a nobody. In other words, to be a nobody, you have to be a somebody. So So Reb Broida says they create a form of, although they claim they're working on anava and humbleness, what they're really doing is trying to create a society where they're going to feel like gaiva. They're better than everyone else because they're humble. And he says it's all a fraud. And he quotes Rav Leibel Shapiro Kovno of Kovno, who I mentioned already today, that he says that these Musarniks, and he's talking about before the, he's talking about where Yisrael Salanter began. It was not for yeshivas. It was for everyone. He created these houses of Musar. Anyone could go there and study. Then the Musar yeshiva, the first one, Slobodka, then it gets really problematic because then you're taking the best and the brightest Talmidim and indoctrinating them into this. But even before that, the whole idea that you're going to spend time in a Musar kois, that sort of thing, many of the Rabbanim were very opposed to it. Look, at the end of the day, why are they so opposed to it? We said people are opposed to new things, especially traditional Judaism is starting to become on the defensive in the late second half of the 19th century. You have Haskalah, you have people not wanting to go to yeshivas anymore. And normally the response to something like this is to revert to tradition, to revert to the conservative approach, hold on to the way things were. Rav Yisrael's answer to this is something new, novel. It takes, you really have to be open-minded to say that we're confronting a new challenge and we're going to respond to it with a new approach. And that was what Yisrael was saying. And so most of the rabbis didn't want new approaches. They just want to go back to the old way of doing things. And what is he? So in referring to even before the yeshivas, the earlier Musar people, there's individuals who just wanted to get together as a group and work on themselves. What does Reb Leibel Shapiro say? That they are worse and have done more damage to us. More Yoser Michaside Galitzia. They've done worse to Torah Judaism than the Hasidim in Galicia. And we've suffered on account of them. And then he goes on and says that the big problem with these is that everyone wants to create a cut. Instead of being one Jewish people, you create a sect. And once you create a sect, then you have your own rules, your own clubs, and who knows where it's going to lead to. And he says, look at all the sects and all the problems they've caused us. Hasidim, Maskilim, Musarim, he calls them Musarim. And everyone makes they build themselves a tower, a migdol, and they say that we're the ones, we're the Arayim, we're the Musar people, and And he says it's that that's the problem, that they create a whole movement which divides the Jewish people, separates them from everyone else. And he can and he concludes with a call to the Rabbani. Don't be silent, don't be quiet. God wants you to stand up and join our side to uproot this this terrible movement. Now we know that people privately wrote to Rav Meir Feimer and saying, how could you say this? How could you know this extreme language of yours? We know that because Rav Meir Feimer responds to them. He publishes another open letter, and he says that, don't tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. He'd tell that to me because I said, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He says, don't tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. I live here. I see what's going on. And he says, if you find exceptions to the rule, we don't learn from the prat on the call. He says, I do not trust the Menahalim there, namely the Altar of Sobotka and the others, that they're interested in bringing the students to Torah and Yira. And he says, and why did they bring the students from Sobotka here when there's already a machlokas going on? So remember, we said that the students, they come, we think, at least he assumes so, that the Ritbaz bring these students in to help him in his battle with Rav Meir Feimer. So Rav Meir Feimer already is prejudiced against them because he sees and he tells you explicitly that the students are coming to be on the other side, the opposition to him, because they're in a yeshiva which is aligned with the rabbi who he's in a fight with. And he says, from this came Chil Hashem Gadol. And then he says, and what about you say, the Meir Feimer's replying, that my words are going to hurt yeshivas? And he says, no, on the contrary, people will see what a real yeshiva is about and how you have to establish proper yeshivas. And he too quotes Rav Leibel Shapiro. Leibel Shapiro is obviously, I mean, he's not a household name now, but you see that in his, that these Rabbanim are quoting him a generation afterwards as such an important figure. He says he heard from Rav Leibel that to study Musar occasionally, it's a great thing. Inyan Gadol, v'darushu ma'od. It's important to study Musar. What could be taken from the Mesilas Yesharim or one of the other great Musar books? That's very important. But to have chaburas on it, to bring people together, inyan mesukan hu. This is dangerous. Chalila, chalila. Today we take it for granted. So you say, what would be what's so problematic? But you see how they were worried of where it would lead to, and they had a history with this. They had, the Hasidic movement, and they had other. And in general, as a conservative society, anything new is a problem. Daf Yomi had machlokes. How many people oppose? It's hard to know it today because everyone does Daf Yomi. You want to see opposition to Daf Yomi? Take a look at what the Munkacs, your Rebbe, writes about Daf Yomi. All the ways that Daf Yomi is so terrible and so bad. And you're reading it and you're wondering, here we're now, almost 100 years after he wrote it, and nothing he wrote about, came to fruition. But he's talking about how terrible it is. And really, there's a subtext there. And he even says it once, that the whole point of Daf Yomi, he sees, is as a way of Agudas Yisrael strengthening itself. And he was a big opponent of Agudas Yisrael. He didn't see them really any different than the Mizrahi or the Tzionim. So anything that would strengthen Agudas Yisrael, he opposed. But he had also substantive reasons. And the major substantive reason is we've been learning Gemara now for how many thousands of years? And none of the other, the Rambam never came up with this. None of the other Gedolim came up with this. So now the Aguda is going to come up with this idea. So that in and of itself in the traditional society is enough of a reason to throw it out and say it's useless. But try telling that to the people who do Daf Yomi. They don't see any, they can't find a problem with it. But you see how something that's accepted today at a time, it could be a different time, it could be very problematic. And then he continues, he says that I know, Rav Meir Feimer says, right now I am not a rabbi and I'm not a dayan. Remember, he's a private citizen. In fact, they made his son the official rabbi, but he really is the unofficial rabbi for the people in opposition to the Ritbaz and Slutsk. But he says, maybe a rabbi shouldn't say this, but he says it. Nevertheless, even though I'm not a rabbi or a dayan right now, Todah le'el, thanks to God, im kozo Todah le'el, Lo nofela nochi b'minas ha'emes mikama rabbanim gedolim hayoshim ba'arim gedolos. He says, I'm not any less important when it comes to understanding the truth than the other than great rabbis in other cities. In other words, don't say that I shouldn't have an opinion because I'm not sitting in a a big city as a Rav. He says, I'm the equivalent of those rabbis, and I see it up close, and I'm telling you, this is a problem. Okay. I want to move now to read. We have to look at some of the responses. And actually, before I get to that, I want to. No, I'll get to, we'll get to it later. I want to talk about when it, we won't get to it today. I thought we would. I have some good pictures to show you, but I'll show you next class. What's your appetite for some of the pictures? Well, here, I'll just show you one picture. Because in this picture is going to be an entire movement. An entire. Just take a look at these. When you think about Musar, actually, it's good to show it now. Because we're going to talk about the whole philosophy, the whole ideology of Walter Sobotka. Take a look at the way they're dressed. Take a look at how dignified, and that's what a Sobotka Bachur looks like. And so what's the ideology that, and I'll show you more pictures. Actually, I'll show you another picture now. I'll show you these pictures again, but I'll show you them. I'll show you them now because it's good to bear in mind when we had all this negative stuff about it. Here, we'll get to him next class as well. You know who that is? That's Rav Yosef Sussmanovitz. He's known as the Yerushalmi. Look at how he's dressed. That's his wife. He's engaged there, not married. That's his future wife. That's the daughter of Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Hashiva of Sobotka, later in Hebron. I'm assuming it's before they're married, because that's how it's identified. I don't know whether she wore a shadow or not, but she looks. But look, even aside from that, just look at the neck. You know, this is not. First of all, would a yeshiva guy to? By the way, the Yerushalmi, he was born in Eretz Yisrael when he comes to Sobotka, but he's a gon shebagonim, and if depending on how long this course classes go, we will deal with unbelievable machlokas he had over who's going to take over the Sobotka yeshiva. Ostensibly, it's about Yerusha. But in the background, Musar is also a big thing. But this is a Gaon Sheba Gaonim, unbelievable, with the Yerushalmi he's called. But would a yeshiva bachur today, before they're married, take a picture like this with a bride? I don't know. You can tell me. And I would the girl have, according to Rabbi Falk's book, you can't show the neckline like that. It's usher, according to what they say, how you're supposed to show the neckline. But look how, for don't look at, oh, by the way, they're both, you look at them, you have to feel sad. Martyred in the Holocaust. At the time, he was serving as Rav of Vilkomir, and she was the Rebbetzin. Martyred. Al Kiddush Hashem. But look at him, and look at the dignity and the dress, and... I could show you many, many more pictures of that as well. And that's a point that no one's going to criticize the way they dress and how they look, at least not in in Europe. Or in Eretz Yisrael, they did. Okay, so why do I mention this now? Because the next step, I think, in this feud, as it heats up, I'm just, you know, picking the... what I think are the important things to stress is now we have two major rabbanim with open letters and hamelitz attacking the Musar schools. And so, of course, there's going to be a response. And Katz in chapter 6 deals with it. The first of the responses. Now, this is like a no-name person. Later, we're going to see. We'll have to count the big rabbanim on each side. I tell you that there's more big rabbonim on the anti-Musar side. At least I believe so. We'll count them. But there's a lot of big ones on the other side, including the school that becomes the center for attacks is Navardik. And none other than the Aruch HaShulchan is the Rav of Navardik. And one Aruch HaShulchan is equal to maybe five of the other rabbonim. So we'll be able to put on each side the different gedolim. But... the first open response, or response in Hamelitz, is by a rabbi who wrote it anonymously. He wrote it as Shem Tov Benayel. We don't know who he is. It would be great to know who this rabbi was. He was probably a young rabbi who then became well-known. He says as follows, and basically he was saying what I was saying. He He begins by saying that he doesn't understand what this criticism is all about. He says, "We all agree," he says, "that Musar is important for Taras Amidos Be'er Hashem. You need to, we all agree that Musar is important, the study of Musar, to improve your character." Now, he says that it's actually not true. We're going to see what Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said in the Lashon, because not all agree that you should spend time on Musar, at least not in the yeshiva setting, you know, on your own privately, or maybe, or not in an organized setting, I should say, because Rav Chaim also wouldn't oppose it on your own occasionally when you wanted to. But he says, we all agree that the study of Musar is important. And he says, so what's wrong with organizing Musar study in a group? He says, every Jewish city, you'd have, he says, you have a Cheres in Yaakov, you have, they were in Menorah Samaor, you have Agudas Agudos. And that's how it was in Europe, in old time Europe. You don't know what to say because today there's a Daf Yomi Shir in every town, 6 a.m. or sometimes earlier, and everyone goes and they go and they bring their art scroll. People can't even read Hebrew and they're at Daf Yomi. That's not the way it was in Europe. In Europe, who learned Gemara? The only, first of all, you couldn't learn Gemara unless you've been to a yeshiva student, because there wasn't an art scroll, but there never was an ideology that anyone learned Gemara. You weren't supposed to learn Gemara. They didn't want you to learn Gemara. The only people who were supposed to learn Gemara were the Talmidei Chachamim. The Hamonam, they're supposed to, let's say, they'll come to the Ein Yaakov group, or they'll come recite Tehillim, or maybe if they're a little, know a little more, they were in Cheder for another couple of years, they'll go Chevra Mashiach. In other words, there was division in old Europe of, in pre-war Europe, between in each town. They didn't have TVs and things like that, so everyone was involved in something. But there was no conception that everyone should be learning Gemara. On the contrary, so everyone would do other things. So his response is, well, if everyone already is coming together in different groups to learn other things, what's the problem with coming together to learn a Musar Sefer? I mean, he even mentions that that people will come together to learn Menorah Samaor. That's a Musar, that's a medieval Musar work. So what's wrong with, you know, if a group of guys come together and read it with the rabbi, why can't you have organized groups all over doing this? Now, learning Menorah Samaor, though, because he would say that they never regarded themselves as a separate group. It was just a time to come together to learn. That's different than the Musar movement, because the Musar movement sees themselves as a special an entity, that they're special, that they set up a different way of learning and a way of self-examination. It's not just they're coming to read a Sefer once a week or something like that. But okay, so he says, what's the problem? Incidentally, in the opposition of Daf Yomi, which still continues in the Satmar and those others in the really right-wing Hasidic circles, one of the things that you'll see is they say that Daf Yomi is wrong because Talmud is not supposed to be for the masses. It's supposed to be an elite work. They're not supposed to, and they're not supposed to learn that. They're moving beyond their pay level, as it were. Gemara has to be something that you earn. And art school makes it too easy, because you don't need to steig and suffer over it and spend time learning. And in any event, the philosophy is that Gemara is designed only for the elites. And who's an elite? Someone who sat in yeshiva for many years. No one else is supposed to be learning Gemara. So it's about a restrictive view of, not against the democratization of Talmud study. Torah study, yes. Everyone should know their place. Incidentally, Rav Avadya Yosef had the same approach, but for a different reason. Not for some idea of, you know, elitism. That's not what Rav Avadya said. Rav Avadya's position was that you only have, let's say, an hour a week, a day to learn. You're supposed to learn halacha. Halacha. Thing is, though, how many people are going to wake up 6 a.m. to go through Shulchan Aruch? Gemara is more interesting. So he's that. That's the first thing he says. And then he continues by saying, if the people who disagree with Musar, they too will agree that it's okay to learn. So why are they so concerned if other people are doing it? Okay, he repeats, is basically repeating it. And then he says, if it's true that you don't like the menali, the word menahel is basically the same as the mashgiach, the people who run the yeshiva. If you don't like the menal, you don't like the altar of Sabatka, So what does that have to do with the Mesilas Yesharim, Chovos Levavos, Bechinas Olam? Why can't people still learn these? He's sort of skirting the issue here, the major issues. And then he gets into the crux of the issue I mentioned before. He says, where do you get this notion? And where is there any source among the Musar schools that it's usur to be a Bucky and Shas and Rishonim and Tor, and the only thing you're going to focus on is Ketzos HaChoshen and the Sivos? He says, this is not true at all. What does one thing have to do with the other? Then he turns to the Maskilim. He says, shouldn't Maskilim were very opposed to the Musar. Shouldn't you admire these people? These are people who have an idealism. Isn't that what the Maskilim were all about, a form of idealism? He says that isn't when you have an ideal, isn't this something that people are drawn to? He says, look at Chivat Zion. He says, is anyone going to say that it's usher to be a supporter of Chivat Zion, of return to the land of Israel, just because some people are opposed to it? He's saying basically among us and Lita. Who is opposed to Chibat Zion at this early stage? This is before the Zionists, before the secularists. So who would be opposed to it? Yeah, a few people might be opposed to it, but we're not going to say it's usher to be part of it. So the same thing, the Musar, what are they doing? Their idealists are coming together. So that's what he says. Now, what I will do next time is we have to speak about, first of all, what the supporters of Musar, what's the main advantage of Musar? Like, why do you need Musar? We haven't yet seen that yet. We've seen it as an individual level. Everyone needs to improve their Yirat Shamayim, but there's going to be societal factors involved here. You know, traditional Judaism is hemorrhaging, and Musar is going to be a way of stopping the hemorrhaging, of giving strength to the students, giving them, at least so it was thought, and by World War I, everyone concludes that Musar is going to be very important. And then we're going to take us into the Slabodka Yeshiva. Because now we've seen, this is 1897, all the letters that we've back and forth, the three letters so far we've seen in four. 1897, the great dispute in the Slabodka Yeshiva begins. Now, the way I'm describing it is how Katz describes it. However, Shlomo Tikhachinsky, in our, first you have the Slutz controversy, which then leads into the Slabodka break. However, Tikhachinsky, in his book, Lamdanut Musar V'Elitism, Learning Lamdas Musar and Elitism, Yeshiva Slabodka from Lita to Israel, he portrays it differently, actually. He thinks that the problems begin in the Slabodka Yeshiva, and it's because of that that then leads to the whole issue in Slutz. But either way, it's not important for our purposes, but we're going to, the great Yeshiva Slabodka, the Musar Yeshiva, first of the great Musar Yeshivas, controversy reaches into the yeshiva itself, and the result is a split in the yeshiva. And do you know that the Musar people were the minority? They ended up losing. They were the minority. The majority agrees to split. And we'll have to talk about who this great figure, the Altar of Slabodka, is. Try to get maybe beyond a little of the hagiography that's been built up on him, and see what's his ideology here. Why do you need a Musar yeshiva? What's wrong with all the other yeshivas that we've had? So talk a little bit about Godless Adam. So let me see some of the questions. Jacob says that in Manhattan, young people eat salmon and tuna sushi more frequently than cooked. Yeah, so I should have said, but salmon we always ate it. Lox, right? So uncooked. But you're saying that they eat it more frequently than cooked. So does that mean that I can then, do I need to ask a Shaila and what of a Rav? And yes, could be you ask a Rav and he doesn't know the Metzios. So, or is this just something? It's black letter Shulchan Aruch that if it's eaten raw, it's not Bishul Akum. A carrot. I don't have to ask a rabbi if I can eat a carrot cooked by a goy because I know that. So can I just decide on my own that tuna is? I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think it's disrespectful to say that Rabbi Tendler wasn't paying attention to the weddings he went to, where he would have seen all the people lined up at the sushi bar. Chaim says that the Vod of the Five Towns notes if a store uses Bishul Yisrael tuna on each hashgacha. So you are saying, Chaim, that the Vod of the Five Towns allows Bishul Akum tuna? That seems to be what you're saying. So that would mean that the Vod of the Five Towns has changed its perspective and saying that you say that they mention if they don't have Bishul Yisrael Tuna. Okay, well, I guess so. That's what you're meaning. I don't know. Rabbi Kelman says that Beryl Wine writes in one of his books, in his very first day working as a lawyer, he forgot the Daven Mincha. It still took him 9 years to transition to a rabbi. Yeah. Look, like I said, the Shulchan, what did the Chazon Ish say? The Chazon Ish says the Mishnah tells you about a case. What happens if the Rav paskens that the woman's can marry and then the husband shows up? So that shows it can happen. So if the Shulchan Aruch tells you what you're supposed to do if you forget Shachris, Mincha, or Ma'ariv, then you could take a nap Shabbos afternoon and wake up and all of a sudden it's dark outside. So it happens. But Rav Weinberg, he forgot it because he was learning. And when you're learning, you just you forget it. Moshe says, like the Akedah, Avram was willing, but he didn't have to go through with it. That's what I said. I thought of that as I was telling the story, that it's just like the Akedah. You go to the door, right, as it were, and then you don't finish. Nissen says, apparently, if Weinberg is made into a Davar Hara Ulabila by the altar. Jerry Kelman says, it should be obvious. Can't leave the Rosh Hashanah Mincha, and really is no Chiddush, but sadly it is. You say it's obvious, Rabbi Kalman. I don't think so, because people get up and leave the drushas for all sorts of reasons that don't even come close to the importance of the Mincha.
People
get up to answer a phone call. People get up because they're tired of this drusha and they want to leave. So if, I'm trying to think though, if you're one of these people who just gets up and leaves the drusha when you feel like it, then maybe you are obligated to go to the Mincha.
No, I agree with you in reality. I'm just saying it's there. It should be a double pressure. Human decency. You don't walk up when somebody's speaking. I can't take it when I go to Mincha and the rabbi speaks between Mincha and Mariv and 20 people walk out and they come back for Mariv. If I ever have to leave between Mincha and Mariv, I won't come back for Mariv. I don't know. But
No, you have to do it. You have to
you
do
don't
it.
Come back for Mariv.
You have to leave before Aleinu. You have to leave before Aleinu.
And not
you
come
can't
back
leave
for Mariv.
As soon as they finish Kaddish, and then everyone they announce, okay, the Shir. Sometimes I speak, between Mincha and Mariv. So right when we finish, then everyone who wants to leave, they go for the door.
Basic derech
eretz. I tell my sons, if you want to leave, you have to leave before. Right after Shemona Esrei or something. And we need to go learn.
Mark, all I'm saying is if you leave even before Aleinu, don't come back for Mariv. I don't think you should come back for Mariv.
Well, why? I mean,
I don't know. I think it's obvious. You walked out for the rabbis like Russia, and it's not. I don't think it's right. Okay, that's me. I'm crazy.
Okay. No, I don't look. But sometimes people like have a Seder. I could see and.
Maybe you could tell the rabbi. But I'm saying as a normal, yes, there are always 50,000 exceptions. But as a basic rule, it's derech eretz. Derech eretz katma
l'Torah. Okay, but that's so. That's the Chazon Ish, though, but I think it's a double question also. Chaim says, I didn't know this, Chabad, the ceremonial Malkus on Erev Yom Kippur. That means they have a little, light little belt where they do it. Incidentally, in Jerba, I'll show you the picture next class, the video next class. They pull up the shirt and they do it. I don't know if Chabad does that. I'm going to have more Chabad near me. Because Kahat Publishers, Kahas, I think they call it, that's the publishers of Chabad, and they had different offices in Brooklyn. They just bought a big 100,000 square foot place in Scranton, and they're transferring all their operations there. So all of the Chabad printing is going to be out of Scranton, and that's where I work. And they won't be living in Scranton, they'll be living in Kingston, Pennsylvania, about a half hour from Scranton. You now have a community of probably 175 Chabad families, working people, not shulchim. Most people don't know regular Chabad people. Working people, they have a restaurant, food store. It's an amazing thing to see, and they just brought in a Rav. Until then, they didn't have a Rav. They had a few shuls. The Rav is named Rabbi Oberlander. He comes from Muncie. He's a cousin of the Rabbi Oberlander we'll see this summer in Budapest. He's formerly from Papa. There was a whole conversion of some of these people from Williamsburg in the, I think, the early 80s into to Chabad, and now they're big Talmidei Chachamim, and he's the Rav. He for years he edited the Torah journal Heichal Habesht, and also the Or Yisrael. He might still edit, if it still appears, Or Yisrael. So a very big Talmud Chacham. And that's right near Scranton. Moshe says that there's a story in Meir Eina Agola that the Chidushi Harim was talking and learning with Rehi Eger and the Chemda Shlomo in Warsaw, but he didn't daven yet, and they started to sit down and eat. So to hold on, I'm missing a word here. It's covered up. So he started a discussion about what bracha is made in the food, and he said, "I have a sefer at home that discusses the matter." He excused himself quickly at home to get the sefer. Okay, so he's into, you're saying the whole idea is that Osek B'mitzvah. You say, I believe Rav Szymanowicz was a chavrusa with Professor Rieger in Slabodka based on the biography of Sarah Rieger, where she mentions Eloi from Yerushalayim. Yes, obviously. There's only one Eloi from Yerushalayim. And that's, in fact, he wasn't even known as Rav Szymanowicz. He was known as the Yerushalmi. Even in Jerusalem, he wasn't called Szymanowicz. The name was Szymanowicz in Europe. His father goes on Aliyah, and he changes his name to, I think, Dan Yechiah, because they had a tradition that they were from a Sephardic family. So why didn't he stay in Eretz Yisrael and learn? Because the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael were not considered in good yeshivas. They weren't considered high-quality yeshivas. Tzvi Pesach Frank sent his son to learn in Tells. Sarah Rieger, unfortunately, Professor Sarah Rieger passed away last summer. She actually passed away when we were on our trip to Tunisia, and we had someone on the bus who grew up with her and who knew her. So when I announced it to the bus that she just passed away, she wrote on all various matters, but most of concern to us is that her father was a yeshiva student, and he wrote a memoir, and she translated it and published it. And that memoir, I published it. I have a series, Academic Studies Press. I published Gil Pearl's book on the Netziv. I published a number of books, and I published her book, and it's fascinating. Moshe says, reminds me of Uriah Heep and David Copperfield. Well, I have to confess, I don't know who Uriah Heep is and David Copperfield. I haven't read it. Yeah. So why does someone ask privately, why does Refimer single Achasidei Galitzia? No, Refimer quotes Rav Leibel Shapiro as saying how destructive the Polish Hasidim, let's say, were. Why were they, that the Musarniks were more destructive? I don't know. I'm thinking maybe in Lithuania, the Hasidim are not so problematic because you're in Lithuania. If he's a Misnagid living in Poland, he might have a different opinion. I don't know. We're just saying Hasidim. I don't know why Hasidim in Galicia are more problematic. If I could speculate, I think maybe they thought that they were more Amoratsim. You know, some Hasidic groups are the ones in Russia where Chabad were known to be Big Talmidei Chachamim. It could be, you know, there's lots of Hasidim there. You had all sorts of Rebbes. The amount of Rebbes is unbelievable. And half these Rebbes were Amoratsim from the Lithuanian standpoint. Maybe that could be, I don't know. Moshe says, you could argue that the Gemara was never originally meant for the layperson. One example we find is the concept of halacha ve'emorim king. Yeah, the Gemara tells you this is halacha, but you shouldn't let the masses know. So that implies that the masses are not supposed to read it, otherwise they'll know. That defeats the whole purpose. And I've said already in the past that Rabbi Kelman certainly remembers this. You have certain stories that just are wild, and it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, stories, for instance, criticism. The example I always give is the rabbi's riding on the donkey. And he sees this guy and he says to him, like, you're the ugliest person. And it says, well, then who made me? God. And the upshot of the story is that the rabbi really acts like a jerk, and he recognizes the error of his ways. This is something that rabbis can say to themselves, to criticize themselves. But I can't imagine that you'd have a story like this that let the masses know, or even maybe the stories where the rabbi comes to a city and says, I want a woman for a night. That's the sort of story maybe that among each other, like rabbis talking to each other and say certain things, they could criticize each other. You have a very harsh criticism of some of the rabbis. Is that the sort of thing they would have said if this was something that the masses were supposed to read? So at least it's a theory. There is indeed a recording of about Rav Ruderman talking not just about, he speaks all about, I have the recording, actually. I'm looking on, the title of it is Questions and Answers About the Altar. And you got to listen to it, because the students, he's in a generation after the one we're speaking about now, although he is the Yerushalmi generation. You see that the students asking the questions sort of can't accept what he's telling them. It's like it's hard for them to grasp the things he's saying. Barry, Rabbi Hartman, when I came to MTA Rav Lesson, was there. He was the Rav Lessin, was the Mashkiach. He's a Sobotka Musar personality. He's Rav Avigdor Miller's father-in-law, correct, if I'm right. I did not appreciate him, but the Rebbeim always told us how perfectly dressed he was, just to counter the Maskilim, who argued that Yeshiva people do not dress well. I recall how Rav Lessin's shoes were always so well polished. Okay, you make an excellent point, Barry, and we'll speak about it next class. Because is Slobodka Musar, when they say you have to dress a certain way, is that about because the chitzonios, the outside, has to reflect the panimios? If you're clean and pure on the inside, you'd be clean and pure on the outside. Or is there also an angle that you mentioned, the maskilim, that the maskilim are dressing this way and the university students are dressing this way? I'm going to argue that they're both there, that you have to have both elements, that Musar dress is also, and just bourgeois mentality is also in many ways a response to the outer world. But look, Rav Lessin, he was a Musar personality, but he also, even in YU, not everyone, the Rav gave him great kavod. And the Rav, when Rav Lessin would come into Shiurim to give like a Musar shmooze, the Rav would sit there and listen to the Musar shmooze. But Rav Volk, I have to say, it's a famous story. Rakefa tells it also, that one year at the end of Yom Kippur, you could see how a Musar person could say it. I guess they did this in Slobodka. Fast is over, but everyone's going to run out and start eating. And, that's not so appropriate. So Rabbi Lessin says that, starts giving like a short Musar schmooze. You know, we finished in Rosh Hashanah. Hopefully, you know, we davened well. No, Yom Kippur, sorry, you were davening well, the gates closed, hopefully we're given, another year, whatever it is. He wants to just give some inspirational message before everyone, runs out and goes eating. And Rav Volk screams out, enough with this, you have women here, children, they're hungry, we gotta go, So he humiliated him, he embarrassed him. And you know something, no? Later, when Rav Volk needed a shidduch for his daughter, he went to Rav Lessin. I don't know if Rakefet mentions this in his book, but this is true. He went to Rav Lessin, and Rav Lessin, as a true Musar personality, was able to overlook the humiliation, and Rav Lessin helped him. Because that's what it means to be a Slobodka person. Moshe says, Menorah Samor is a Likud of Chazal. Very different. Okay, yeah, I guess so. Chaim says, yeah, they have a box. They have a check or lack thereof on the box or Bissel Yisrael, as far as I know. Okay, interesting. And you say that they recite Hurachum while they do the Malkos. I haven't seen that. Rabbi Kalman reminds everyone to register for another great program they have before Pesach. And Chaim, you, the Bissel Yisrael tuna standards here. I'm going to take a look at the Bissel Yisrael tuna standards. That'll be something interesting for me to see. And Uriah Heep's tagline was how humble he was. Hey, but look, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote in the Sefer Torah. He's the most modest. So the question was, how could he write it and still be the modest? So that's the chat, that he could write it and still be modest. That's why he's different than us. That's why he's special than us. And you say Rav Robert, Big Toronto Connection, writes the Hasidim Megalitza were Amaratzim. That was the, like I said, that was the accusation that they were Amaratzim. It was more of a popular religion. And the rabbis often complain in places like that, the Rebbe comes to town and all of a sudden no one pays attention to the rabbi. And the rabbi has to go then to meet the Rebbe. And the rabbi thinks it's like beneath his dignity. The rabbi, the rabbis were often like, they were miracle workers. They were magicians. They were all these sorts of things. Chaim says, were Litvaks Misnagim always clean shaven? In the yeshivas, they were always clean shaven. Sure. In the late 19th, early 20th century, they were always clean shaven. You know who was not clean shaven? The rabbein. They had a beard. And today, as far as I know, you can, in all these yeshivas, you can have a beard. It's not an issue anymore. But you could not have a beard in Slobodka. You were not allowed to have a beard. You couldn't wear black either, black and white. That's for the Rosh Yeshiva. We'll speak about the dress code. Because if you think that the yeshiva dress code today is somehow a continuation from Slobodka and the Musar Yeshiva, is absolutely incorrect. So Rav Yossi said in Sota, who is an onav, one like someone who's like myself. Okay. Listen, there's a shita that today you can praise yourself. What's the pasuk? Zari mihauch, I forget now. There's a shita that today's day and age, You have to toot your own horn. They've come up with all these reasons. I said it before. You go to websites today. Websites put up rabbis about themselves. And they'll say things like, Rabbi Plony has a unique gift in explaining the most difficult sugyas. And you ask yourself, how could the rabbi write that about himself? You know, whatever happened to Anivus, let other people do it. But there's a theorem that today you need to... do you want to spread the Torah? How's it go again, Nissen? But look, it makes me uncomfortable, but I know that there's a heterium to do it. Thank you all. It was great. Like I said, we're sort of just getting started here, and this is our fifth class. But I'm in for it if you're in for it, because it's only getting exciting now. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Yes, we have no start and end deadlines. We just, and we go and we go. Whenever we finish. That's the way it goes. That's what I like. That's, I think, what the people like. So very good. Okay, tomorrow Rabbi Shulman finishes his, as he started back in Elul, his series on Kohelet. So, all right, you can come, Achron Chaviv. You can come like a seal on Erev Pesach. You know, you don't have to learn the whole Masechet. You just come for the last thing you can eat. That's tomorrow. And then our regular shiurim will be, in addition to the Yom HaYun, we're doing on the Haggadah. If you didn't see, basically, we're going through the Haggadah from Kadesh Ruchatz, Karpas Yachatz, through Shulchan Aruch. We're going to stop at Shulchan Aruch. 9 speakers, every speaker half an hour each, just in the order of the Haggadah. So you can. That's the program on April the 14th. We'll also have a number of other shiurim, you know, just regular shiurim before Pesach. So, all right, be on the lookout for that. And I want to wish everybody well. And we hope to see you soon. And invite a friend to come and enjoy the weather. April Fool's Day today. Whatever that means. Okay. Does anybody practice April Fools anymore? That's like a thing. I don't know if they still do that. Okay. Anyway, all right, everybody be well. Let's look forward to learning with you in the near future.